Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. Minutes past 8 o'clock. It is Monday morning, February 22nd, 2021. Good morning, everybody. I'm Scott Micklin. Thanks for tuning in to KSJE 90.9 FM over the air here in San Juan County, New Mexico, 103.3 FM over the air in Durango, Colorado, and streaming everywhere from our website at ksje.com. Welcome also to our viewers who are watching this visual radio program. We are streaming live this morning to the KSJE Facebook page, our YouTube channel, and our Twitter account. So we're glad that you're with us, however you found your way to us this morning. Great to have you along, because we're talking about history, one of my favorite topics, local history, of course, the Lost Communities of Navajo Dam. And author Patty Tharp is my guest. We'll be talking with her in the next few moments, so stay tuned for a fascinating discussion about some of these communities that used to make up the area around Navajo Lake, which of course were inundated with water when the dam and lake was constructed. So we'll be talking about that in the next few moments this morning, right here on KSJE. At 8:50 this morning, I'll talk with Lewis Campbell from Synergy Computer Systems. We'll talk technology on our Monday reboot section. And then, of course, Mick Hess will be here roving with the arts after the news at 9:06. It's our classical music program. And this morning, Mick is playing selections from Henryk Gorecki, a Polish composer, coming up this morning on Roving with the Arts. So you'll hear that coming up today, next hour on KSJE. And of course, don't forget, you can also connect with us in addition to our Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter accounts. If you're a social media person, check us out on Instagram as well. Our weather forecast outside right now, sunshine with a high of, or current temperature, I should say, of 26 degrees. We're on our way, though, to a high of 48 today, 22 and clear overnight, mostly sunny tomorrow, a bit warmer with a high of 53. 53 and partly sunny skies on Wednesday, but then take a look, another chance of rain or snow showers Wednesday night on into Thursday with a high of 47 on Thursday. Then sunshine returns on Friday with a high of 48, maybe mid-50s for the weekend with a high of 56. Well, let me turn to my guest, who is here with me this morning. Great to have her in the studio. Patty Tharp is here, the author of The Lost Communities of Navajo Dam, Volumes 1 and 2. And Patty Tharp, good morning. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Wonderful to have you here to talk about this kind of labor of love, I might say, that you've been doing for, what, the past 4 years?
Yes. Yes. I started in the early 2017.
And that was with Volume 1.
Yes.
Right?
Well, I was working on both of them actually simultaneously.
Okay.
Because people needed to be interviewed.
Makes sense.
From all the communities.
Right.
And of course, many of them were getting older. And plus, my opportunity to interview them was through two wonderful ladies, Delia Velasquez and Naomi Gallegos, who I learned about through my earlier research, and they opened so many doors. It was just if it hadn't been for them, I wouldn't have been able to do this, because Naomi especially, she would say, oh, you need to call Viola Lucero, or oh, you really need to interview Philomena Abeta. And I'd say, would you call them for me?
Right.
And she'd say, well, sure. And I'd say, will you go with me? Sure. And so I can't tell you how wonderful that was, because here I am, an Anglo, a stranger, and for them to go and they start talking in Spanish to begin the the whole interview was just fantastic. And pretty soon my guest was relaxed.
Very good.
And they brought out pictures. And I have a debt of gratitude to Delia and Naomi especially.
Wonderful.
For all their help.
Well, and so because of that, we get to hear a lot of these first-person accounts, right? And some of these stories of these families that were really impacted by what you've written about.
Exactly, exactly. And that is what my focus was not to repeat what had already been written, because as you can see, first of all, I had 48 pages in this,
right,
including the front and back.
Volume 1.
And then in Volume 2, I persuaded them to double the size because I had 3 communities now. But
right,
I didn't want to repeat what people could read in a history book. I wanted to focus on the people's stories, especially those that had been displaced, to preserve that. Because
right,
after they're gone, you know, I used to teach genealogy, and we'd always say, our elders, our libraries burning. And when they're gone, so are the stories.
That's right.
And so that's what was the most important thing to me.
Fascinating. Let me back up just a second to talk a little bit about what gets us to kind of this whole point of talking to these folks and sharing these stories is that, you know, so in the late 1950s, roughly, there's a plan to maybe make Navajo Dam and Navajo Lake in eastern San Juan County, and that would involve then the flooding, literally, of several communities in the way of this public works project. And so this is kind of what we're talking about, is this whole big, major public works project, obviously, that impacts us all even today, of course. But for these families that had lived in this valley, these river valleys, for generations, they were told by the government, you're going to have to move.
Exactly, exactly. However, the idea for a dam was really thought about around 1912, if you can imagine.
Oh.
The Turley brothers had come to survey, and they said, oh, look, we've got 3 sides here that would be a perfect dam. And in fact, the little community named Turley was named for them before it was called Alcatraz, which means cranes that winter. But the Turley brothers' plan never really got off the ground. I mean, they did a bunch of surveying. Their plans went to Santa Fe. And then in the 1950s, when the Colorado River Storage Project began, which, of course, encompassed dams all the way from Colorado, Lake Powell, and all the way to California, was part of this project.
Right.
You see.
All these dams and reservoirs work kind of together.
Absolutely.
For storing water from Lake Powell to Lake Mead to Navajo Lake.
Absolutely. And they found the Turley plans in Santa Fe, discovered them, and used them.
After all those years.
For the construction, which I thought was very interesting.
Right.
But yes, so that passed the United States Congress in the mid-1950s. And about the construction was going to start in 58.
Okay.
So the people in Los Martinez and Los Pinos, which is closest to our end of the dam, were contacted in 1957, that they had 1 year to evacuate.
To figure something out.
To figure something out. And it was most traumatic.
Sure.
I mean,
and these folks were they farmers? Were they raising livestock? What were they doing?
They were subsistence farmers. Yes, and ranchers. They mm-hmm. had herds of primarily goats or sheep, some cattle, but primarily goats and sheep. And they raised corn and wheat to survive for the,
right,
the following year, for the winter. And they raised what they used because they had no place to store excess.
Right.
See.
And these communities were, population-wise?
Primarily Hispano.
Mm-hmm.
And they had come.
And the numbers were maybe less than 500 people or so?
Well, Francis Swadesh Quintana, who wrote a book called Pobladares in 1974, estimated that 200 families were displaced.
Okay.
But once word of the displacement was made known, a lot of people picked up and left before that.
Understood. Okay. So these are very small communities.
Yes.
Obviously. But
kind of like Turley is and Archuleta are today.
Right.
That's how you can kind of picture them. They were meandering down the river.
Right.
Like Los Martinez probably was 5 miles or three to five miles long.
Sure.
With little ranchitos along the way.
Right.
Rather like Turley and Archuleta today.
Okay. Got it. And so so the government comes in and says, we're going to build this big dam, and your house, your farm, your ranch is going to be underwater in a few years, so you need to figure out where you're going to go.
Exactly, exactly. And most of the houses were jacals or adobe.
Mm-hmm.
And they were told they could take whatever they could, and so they, thrifty as they were, they salvaged corrals, wood from the corrals, roof nails, anything that they could take with them, because everything was going to be bulldozed.
Right.
And then tried to find a place to go.
And we think about the government coming in and that they would maybe compensate these families for having to pick up and move, and they did to a certain extent, but not to maybe the extent that you would think they should have.
Yes, that's very correct. And the rate that the government was going to compensate was approximately $125 for irrigated land and $85 an acre for dry land. Well, I went over to the San Juan County Courthouse, and under the seller is, sorry.
One of them, either grantor or grantee, right? Right?
But it's one of the them other. Is the Bureau of Interior, or
the
Department of Interior.
I gotcha.
And then under that are the names of the people that were paid. And very few, when you take what they were paid and the acreage, got $125 an acre.
They didn't get even that.
They didn't
they
even
got less
get
than that.
That. Yes. Yes. And if they argued, they got even less, because they were told, well, you can argue all you want, but we're going to condemn it and take it anyway.
This is happening.
Yes.
Right.
So you might as well take what we offer. I mean, it was very unfair.
Sure. And these folks were, and again, we talked before we came on the air this morning a little bit about Spanish speaking, have lived there forever, just, you know, minding their own business, and then the government comes in, and we certainly, I mean, I wouldn't say that the dam is a bad project now. We certainly get a lot of benefits from it. It's a hydroelectric plant. It has recreational opportunities and all these different things, but certainly a major, major change for that community, because
for all four of them.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, all four,
all
because
right.
The first volume talks about Los Martinez.
Correct, Los Martinez.
And that was a town that was destroyed, but not from the water necessarily, right?
Correct.
It was destroyed in a different way.
Correct, it was. Los Martinez, if you know the little church, Our Lady of Guadalupe, on the way to the dam, you pass it.
It's off on the distance, left, a little bit, right?
On a hill where, and you can see what happened there, is the people were evicted because their homes were going, the whole area was going to be used for fill dirt, for the earthen dam, as well as construction site offices. So when you drive toward the dam, toward
right.
By the spillway, you'll see, first of all, where the trailer park was, because all of the earth around it was dug out, huge cavities on both sides of the road, actually, where the dirt was dug out. And it was around a clock operation.
Sure.
They had big lights at night. And then they did leave the little church on the left. Okay, so if you take from the area by the spillway, across from the spillway, and you go down about five miles, then that was the sprawling little community of Los Martinez.
Okay. And I'm showing a map to our video viewers right now, and that looks like it's around number 31 on the map is Los Martinez, which I think we borrowed from your book. Thank you for letting us do that.
You're welcome.
But that's what we're talking about, is kind of out in that area.
And then was Los Pinos, mm-hmm. which was located. It also was a sprawling ranchitos, but mainly it was located at the confluence of the Pine or the Los Pinos and the San Juan Rivers. And if you're at the lake, you can see where those two come together.
Sure, those canyons that we see now,
exactly.
Right?
So underwater there is where Los Pinos was. But it also, the dam backed up, I think it's 9 miles, I'm not sure, up the Pine. So all of those people there were affected.
Removed. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And so Los Martinez, you talk about in volume one of the book, which has been out now for a couple of years, right?
Yes.
It was published back in
2019.
And the new book that we're talking about today is just out this year. So
yes.
It's hot off the press, as they say.
Yes.
And that is volume two, which then talks about Los Pinos, as you mentioned, and then two other communities of Rosa and Los Arboles.
Yes, because originally I was going to have this be Los Martinez and Los Pinos.
And, in volume one.
And the San Juan, and they're published under the auspices of the San Juan County Historical Society, which has tried to publish a book every year or so in our 32-year history, and actually it's turned out to be 19 in all. And this was number 19.
Right.
Volume two.
Yep.
Well, and they had a stipulation of like 48 pages, including the front pages.
Right.
So I thought, okay, well, I don't want to cut out all these great interviews, so I'll just make this Los Martinez, and I'll figure it out.
Right.
Figure it out.
But they're the ones writing the checks. You got to follow what they want you to do, right? But I think you were pretty persuasive, because volume two is a little thicker than volume one, so you must have twisted some arms.
I did.
And gotten more pages.
I did. And it's double the size, because, of course, I had three communities
to talk about.
To cover.
That's right. So talk to me about Rosa, New Mexico. What's Rosa's story, that community?
Well, Rosa was established in the late 1870s, 1880s, by Hispanos, primarily who were from the Abiquiú area, El Rito, Abiquiú. Now, some of them had moved to Tierra Amarilla mm-hmm. area, which was not a town at the time. It was an area. Tierra Amarilla was an area. And
it became a town.
And
it was
later.
The county seat for a long time of the greater
Rio Riba
County, which included the early parts of early San Juan County before
we
separated.
Absolutely. 1887 was when San Juan County was formed from Rio Riba.
Right.
But they came.
And that's a whole other story about the fight between Aztec and farm. We don't even want to go into that this morning, but you'll come back and we can talk about that.
So they were from that area or the San Luis Valley.
Sure.
Because a lot of these people went up to the San Luis Valley.
In Colorado.
In Colorado. In fact, Conejos and Antonito were a part of Taos County until Colorado became a territory in 1861, I believe it was.
Okay.
But before that, it was part of Taos County. So they heard about the area being opened up for settlement after the Bruneau Agreement was signed with the Ute Indians. It was signed in 1874 and ratified by Congress in 1876.
And that's what opened up this entire northwest corner part of the state.
Entire area.
To Anglo and other settlement, non-Native American settlement, I guess is what
correct.
We could say, right?
Correct.
And so these Hispanic families who were familiar with this area came back.
Well, they were familiar only if they had been freighters or their family, somebody in their family had been a freighter, because also who was ignoring the law of invading somebody's territory
right.
were the miners who had gone to the area around Silverton to mine illegally, because that was Ute, that was the Ute territory, you
right.
see, and the Utes were very upset with this. But the government finally persuaded them into signing a treaty. This is called the Bruneau Agreement. And they gave up that area. They gave up all this area except that little strip, you know, which is in southern Colorado now around Ignacio.
Right.
And then the people, it was open for homesteading.
Gotcha. And more development, more mining, more everything, I guess, is what we can see in both Colorado and New Mexico.
Right. So a lot of Hispanos from Abiquiú were on these mule train freights, bringing supplies up to the Anima City and then on up to the area now called Silverton.
Right.
And they went through Largo Canyon. And when they got to Blanco and they saw this fertile valley, it was beautiful. It was like an Eden. And so when they heard that the area had now been open for settlement, a lot of them came
back and settled.
And built their homes
and their ranches and what have you. And that was Rosa, some of the stories, right?
That was all of them.
All of them. Shared that.
That was all of
history.
Them.
Gotcha.
Except Los Arbeles. Now, Los Arbeles was really settled with the coming of the railroad. The Denver and Rio Grande narrow gauge came down to Antonito from Denver,
mm-hmm.
and then went over the Cumbres Pass to Chama, and then was going to go to Durango and on up to Silverton.
Right.
So.
And some folks, pardon me for interrupting, but I'm just.
We're working on that too and heard about the area.
Right. I'm just going to say, cause I think some folks forget or maybe don't know that the tourism trains of Durango and Silverton and the Chama, Cumbres, and Toltec Railroad, they were all connected at one point in time. This is the line that we're talking about, right?
Exactly.
This was all one continuous line to get from, if you wanted to go from Silverton to Denver, you took the train, and it took you forever, but you took the train. That's how you got there.
And you went through Dulce, and you went through Chama and
right.
Antonito up to Alamosa.
And that was the stories about the fruit that was produced here in Farmington would go out on the train once the train got to Farmington. And to get it to Albuquerque took about a month, I think, or I don't know, it took a long time because there was no direct rail link to Albuquerque. You had to go north and east.
To Gallup or...
Yeah. But you couldn't go south by train to Gallup. You had to do that by wagon. So
anyway,
it took forever. But that's another show, too. Now you're coming back for two more shows.
So in 1880, the train began from Chama to go to Durango.
Yes.
And in the 1880s, the crew was in Abiquiú working on it.
Right.
And so a town sprung up around it. And, for example, Bedell Candelaria, who was from the Albuquerque Candelaria land grant family, him and several of his relatives had come, and they had opened up a mercantile store in Los Arbeles, for example. And then it was all tents, you see, at the time, tents, because
right.
it was just sprung up. And there were also saloons, dance halls, dance hall girls, all this stuff. Well, one day in road, Colonel Stolzensteimer, who was, he wasn't the Ute Indian agent yet, but he had been stationed at Fort Lewis, which then was in Pagosa Springs. And that fort was organized to protect settlers against the Utes. Problems.
Right.
And then later, of course, it was moved to Hesperus, as you know.
Right.
But at the time, so he rides in and he says there's going to be a meeting at noon. Everybody gather around. And he said, you cannot have these saloons and dance halls with alcohol on the Ute, because this is part of the Ute reservation. Part of it was on the Ute reservation
okay.
at the time.
Sure.
And so he said, you must leave, and they did. They packed up, and most went to Durango or whatever.
Hmm.
But the businesses then that could stay, they could stay, found that there really wasn't much business, that it was just strictly kind of a railroad town for railroad maintenance. And so that group moved on down into Rosa.
I see.
And Bedell Candelaria opened a store, and later, after his his sister married Jose Vidal Quintana. They became partners, but in 1918 that partnership ended, and then Jose Quintana Vidal opened up his own store called J.V. Quintana and Sons Mercantile Store. But then the Utes were given a chance to have land allotments, and a lot of them, you know, they were never domesticated like the Navajo.
The Utes were not.
The Utes were not. Like the Navajo said, okay, well, we'll raise sheep, we'll plant crops. But the Utes really didn't want any of that. They were given these allotments, but a lot of times they had Hispanos working them. They just did not want to do that. They wanted to be in their teepees. They wanted to hunt and so forth.
Which is what they'd done for years, generations.
For years. They'd gone to the plains of Nebraska and eastern Colorado to hunt buffalo, spend the summer there, dry it into jerky, and bring it back. And they wintered up in the San Juans.
Right.
And so the government said, okay, well, they aren't settling these allotments, so we'll open up some of this area. And they did. There was a land rush then in 1891. And that's really when Arbeliz started to be settled, because they allowed part of Arbeliz then to be settled.
To become a town. It already had the train. And so
where people could have ranches.
Right.
And so there was a land rush there, and little pockets around La Posta and Bondad, also there was a land rush there, too, that
Interesting.
You may have heard of.
Right. And so with Los Arbeliz, I guess that, and we talked before we came on the air, too, that is kind of one of the only remaining of these towns that kind of still is kind of still there, even though part of it is underwater, but it was high enough that I guess only they kind of moved it up the hill?
Well, they moved it. Old Los Arbeliz is gone.
That's gone.
At the confluence of the San Juan and the Piedra. And in Volume 2, there's a great, wonderful map right here. And it was taken by Winnie Walker, who was an amateur.
Let's see. I can show it here. I'll do it. How's that? But you keep talking, because people don't want to see me. They want to see you.
She was an amateur photographer, and her husband, John Walker, and Winnie lived in Los Arbeliz.
Right.
And she rode her horse up onto the mesa and took this picture. And she couldn't get both shots together, one shot, so she put two pictures together. And you can actually see where the river flows and the old part of Los Arbeliz. So all of those people were evicted.
I see.
They had to leave.
They had to move.
But then a lot of them, like Mrs. Barrett, who had her store, and John Walker's son, Jimmy, who was running the store then, another mercantile store, just moved further up the hill, so to speak, where they had, you know, been reopened.
Right. And the land that wasn't going to flood, I guess, is what they were.
And they kept the name Arbeliz. Well, because of the post, they moved the post office, see.
Right. That would do it. And I guess the other point that I want to make about both of your books, Volume 1 and 2, are the pictures that are in these books. These are amazing photographs that you've been able to reproduce and share with us that are parts of maybe private collections or museum collections, but to see them all together and the stories behind them, as you've recalled, are wonderful.
It's a treasure. It's an absolute treasure, because a lot of the pictures, of course, well, most of the people couldn't afford a camera.
Right.
And so sometimes their relatives might come to visit from a bigger city and have a little brownie camera.
Shout out to Kodak. Yeah, there you go. From my roots near Rochester, New York. But yes, right.
And take pictures. Or they did try to go to a studio for a wedding picture.
Sure.
So
for special occasions, that was certainly done all the time. But not like we do it today. We whip out our phones and take a picture of our lunch.
Exactly. Exactly.
You would dream of such a thing.
So in the 1950s, I mean, most families have probably a box of photographs from their own brownies of life and so forth. But like I said, very few people even owned a camera. And so to have whatever I got, I tell you, is just a treasure. It is absolute treasure. And that was one of the things that also, besides the stories of the displaced families, preserving their stories, was to share these photographs, because they are rare.
I would think so, and probably not seen by much of the
public. No, they're in family, you know, they're in the possession of the families.
Exactly.
Primarily.
Right. Well, we're just about out of time this morning, Patty, and it's been fascinating, as I knew it would be, to talk with you about these stories. And so for folks who are listening to us this morning, if they would like to get Volume 1 or Volume 2 or the other, 19 books that have been published by the San Juan County Historical Society, they're sold through the Historical Society, correct?
That's correct. Although the Farmington Museum also sells our books.
In their gift store. Right.
And when the Aztec Museum opens, they will sell them. And in the past, the bookstore here at San Juan College has also sold our books.
Okay.
I don't know if they've got the latest one because of the COVID, probably not being open and everything. But yes, if they contact our San Juan County Historical Society at Post Office Box 1252 in Aztec, 87410, and
they can request a book, and they're $10 a piece, right?
$10 a piece.
Okay.
And also we have an email address so they could see what the postage would be.
Okay.
The postage for one book, I believe, is $2.20.
$2.20, yeah.
For volume two. And then
it's all those extra pages, Patty Tharp, so it's a little heavier. That's what happens.
Then we can go into media rate.
Yes.
But if they want to...
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
You gave me
I did.
She gave me the cheat sheet, and I'm hoarding it and not letting her see it.
But if they want to email us...
Yes.
At...
Is it your address that's on there? Or a different one?
They could email me for sure. I know
on the back of the book there's this CenturyLink address. Is that the one?
That's the one.
So it's SJC Historical NM at CenturyLink.net.
Yes.
And that's there's a phone number too.
Give the phone number.
And the phone number is 334-7136.
Yes.
334-7136. Everyone.
Now we're only in the office three times a week, so leave a message and somebody will get back to you with your questions. Also, we can make arrangements to meet them at the office, or I've even been delivering.
Well, I'm not surprised, right?
Copies around Farmington for people who, you know, can't get out. It's my pleasure.
There you go. But they're available at numerous locations, as we've been mentioning. So the museum is another one that you can go in when the museum's open, and their gift shop is a great resource too. Or order them through the Historical Society. But they are, again, to be, I think, congratulated for supporting this endeavor with you and other local authors to write all of these books about really fascinating parts of San Juan County's history, and that's what they're all focused on.
That's right, exactly. Different facets of the history. Sometimes the pioneers. There's one on place names of San Juan County. I love that one. One of my favorites is abandoned cemeteries that Mary Lou Wayborn wrote for us. And that includes the cemetery at Rosa, where the bodies were exhumed and moved to a new Rosa Cemetery with the coming of the dam, which is also a very interesting story. And I interviewed somebody who, as a college or a high school student, worked on that project.
Wow.
Leroy Olguin. He and his father were hired with a bunch of other laborers, primarily from Durango, to exhume these bodies and move them to the new cemetery. And
amazing.
I have that in volume two, a little bit of that interview. But that was traumatic.
Sure.
And the most traumatic part about that was that very few of those graves had headstones. But people knew, in this corner was my grandparents.
Right, they knew the location, even though it wasn't marked.
But then when they moved all this stuff, there's just rows of unknowns, little plaques that the government put up, unknown, unknown, unknown. And I mean, it just breaks your heart.
It really does. Well, thank you for telling the story. fascinating as it is and painful as it is too to retell. And I think when we go to Navajo Lake and enjoy all that the lake has to offer now, it's interesting to remember those families and those communities that gave so much so that we could have what we have today.
Exactly. And do think about them for sure. And I'd like to just end, if I could, with a quote.
Sure.
From Raymond Gallegos, who lives in California now. And he is the one that did these fabulous reconstruction of the maps.
The maps in the book. Wonderful.
Behind the front cover and back cover of Rosa and both Arbeliz. He and his family lived in Los Arbeliz, and they were evicted. And on the cover is their home. This is their home. It was a frame home, so they were able to move it.
Gotcha.
And okay. That was a sad, sad day to leave their ranch
right.
and move to a location around Ignacio. But Raymond did those fabulous maps, and he wrote to me. He said, "Patty, my first reading was a speed read. This second read is slow and thorough, taking in each biographical sketch, studying it, and enjoying it like dessert after a good meal. My heart goes out to all the old-timers who had put their heart and souls into their land, their families, and extended community families. Thank you so much for bringing it together for us all. You did a fabulous job, and I'm forever grateful." And those are the kind of reviews that I've been getting, and it's so gratifying and rewarding.
I'm not surprised, and thank you for sharing that with us this morning and sharing the whole story of these Lost Communities of Navajo Dem, Volumes 1 and 2, available now. Patty Tharp, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. My guest this morning here on KSJE, and I'll be back with more in just a moment, everyone. The time right now is 8:45. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.